The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Living in the streets. It's in my blood. It's in my blood. Living in the streets. Strong as metal. Strong as steel. Are they Superman? How does that make you feel? Oh, children.
Aloha! I'm Carly Weiner, your Marine Science Gal, on this Wednesday, August 13th. And what you just heard was Jeff Davis's new song. We are talking live today to scientists aboard the NOAA ship Hi'i Alakai, all the way from the Papahana Mokuakea Marine National Monument. This cruise is part of a continuing reef assessment monitoring program, which we will learn more about today. So without further ado, let's share a little bit about this exciting research and talk to some of the people who are there live now. Calling in with us first is Scott Godwin, chief scientist on the Hi'i Alakai. Scott, are you with us?
Afternoon, Carly.
Great. I'm looking forward to chatting with you and hearing a little bit about what's going on. Where are you guys right now?
We're probably a couple hours out from arriving at French Frigate Shoals presently.
Fantastic. And you were delayed a little bit by the hurricanes. Is that going to impact how much time you spend out there, or are you guys pretty much on track now?
We've had to drop one of the islands that we were going to survey. We had to drop Pearl and Hermes Atoll because we lost too many days to displace from the storm.
And have you guys gotten in the water yet, or is that when's the first dive going to happen for you?
First dive operations begin at 7:30 tomorrow morning.
Oh, how exciting. And what will you be looking for when you head out on that dive?
Well, the focus of this trip is multifaceted, but I'm heading up the reef assessment monitoring team. We have a team of benthic ecologists that will be looking at coral, sort of coral population dynamics, but also coral disease. But we also have a fish team that's doing the same, looking at the dynamics of the fish populations up here. And so basically every day we'll be going out trying to get as many sites as we can based on a sort of permanent research design that we have implemented before we come up here.
And that's really important to note, too. So the Reef Assessment Monitoring Program, the RAMP, this is not the first time that you guys have done this. Tell me a little bit about the history behind RAMP.
Well, basically back in 2000, after the creation of the Coral Reef Conservation Act, there was funding from Congress to begin monitoring of the reefs in the territories and states within these tropical areas that have coral reefs. And so in 2000, a multi-agency trip called the now RAMP was basically co-run by the state of Hawaii, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and NOAA. And it was two ships that went up and started the sort of initial assessment, start choosing sites for further monitoring. And every year since then, we have done probably a RAMP trip, now Reef Assessment Monitoring Program trip. And now it alternates between Papahana Mokuakea and the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center and their four reef division. So basically we do 2 years in a row, and then they catch up on the third year.
And when you do the different years, is it always in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, or does it vary in the location?
Our office, Papahana Mokuakea, always does northwestern Hawaiian Islands, but with the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center and the Coral Reef Ecosystem Division, they have RAMP trips that are in the Northern Marianas, in Samoa, and the Pacific Remote Island Territories of the U.S. So they're doing one of those larger trips every other year and doing Northwestern Fawn Island every third year.
And obviously you're focusing on the monument that is where you're based in terms of what you do for work, but what makes Papahanaumokuakea so special? Why is it important to monitor the reefs in this northwest region?
I mean, Papahanaumokuakea sort of represents an area that's one of probably the least impacted coral reef ecosystems left in the tropical Pacific. It's one of the few areas that's had minimal human impact, you know, from like compared to like main Hawaiian Islands where there's a lot of development, a lot of population. The impacts mostly were from, you know, the World War II era, but overall the coral reefs are fairly intact compared to other areas throughout the tropical Pacific. So it's a great area to look at to sort of see what reefs could look like if they are in a intact ecosystem.
It's amazing too how much time goes by so quickly. I mean, in 2012, I was on the research ramp cruise with you, Scott. How is this trip going to differ from last time?
It's, you know, the same as far as our methods and how we do things, but there's a different, you know, crew of people out, and we have our office at Papahanaumokuakea has began a program where we're bringing students from the University of Hawaii, either at Manoa or Hilo or the other, everywhere else, great system. And so we this year we have another set of four students that have been gone through intensive training and are going to be part of the reef assessment monitoring team this year. So we have some new, younger people that will sort of be the next generation of scientists that will be doing this sort of thing.
How exciting. I bet that will be really fun to work with the students. They always bring a huge enthusiasm. Now, I know, Scott, your background is focused on marine alien species and looking for new invertebrates. Is there anything new that you're hoping to discover on this cruise, or are you on the lookout for any particular invasive species?
Yes, I mean, I'm, you know, marine invertebrate taxonomist by most of my research background, but one of the purposes of my job, along with doing coral reef monitoring, is to assess the distribution and the presence of marine alien species, invertebrates, fish, algae, within the Northwestern Islands. And a lot of that research has been done beginning in 2010. I began a reassessment of all of the islands aboard the Hi'ala'kai, mostly in partnership with various agencies and other people within my office, and basically have gotten new distributional records. No new records for marine alien species. They're basically the same alien species that are established in main Hawaiian Islands that are also established in Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, just that we have found those different species at new locations within the Northwest. And that doesn't mean that they recently arrived or the stuff is invading. It's stuff that's been here for quite a while, and it just hasn't been reported before because it's such a huge area to try to survey.
Excellent, Scott. Well, I wish you the best of luck with your dives tomorrow and continuing on. I know Tony is also with you in the cabin right now, chatting with us live from the monument. Tony, are you around?
Hello.
Hi, Tony.
Oh, hey, Carly. It's Tony.
So Tony Paris is the communication manager for the Papahanaumokuakea and is also sailing aboard Hi'ala'kai along with Scott. Now, Tony, this is your first time aboard the Hi'ala'kai and doing field work on a ship. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Carly.
So how's it going so far?
It's going really well. Actually, I have been on some ship-based research expeditions in the past. They've just been to places mostly in the Caribbean, and it took a lot shorter time to get to our destination. So the difference with this expedition that I'm on right now is that it's taking us 3 days as opposed to like a day from my past experiences to get to the first site we're going to actually visit within the monument. Then it's going to take another 2 days to get to our second site that we're visiting within the monument. So it just gives you an idea of the sheer vastness of this place.
It's quite large, and I'm sure there's a lot to cover. Now, what is your role going to be on this particular expedition?
Yes, so my job is to document the research activities that are taking place on board and share that with our co-managers, our partners, and the broader public. Since very few people get to go out to the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, it's our mandate to bring the place to the people as opposed to bringing the people to the place. And we're doing that on this particular expedition through an expedition log on the monument website, which will be updated every few days, and through listserv announcements and social media, and also things like taking part in this radio show, for example. And we're also going to be holding some live Ask a Scientist questions from via Google video chat with some classrooms on Oahu.
Oh, that's fantastic. What age group are you going to be working with for the classrooms?
I believe it's around between 10 and 12.
Oh,
so
that's...
I guess that's fifth-ish or sixth grade.
Oh, fun. They'll really enjoy that. Now, I know you haven't been in the water yet or gone off the boat because you're still transiting, but do you anticipate anything going out into the water? Is there going to be something that you're looking forward to most or something that you're concerned about being challenged with?
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to going out on the small boats and accompanying the researchers on their research just so I can see what it's like. It takes a lot to get out here, get into the water, and, you know, you don't know how the conditions are, and you only have a couple of days at most to get done what you need to do, then you're not coming back for maybe another year or two. So I would really like to see, I've been really impressed with how the science party is preparing for this and all the safety drills, and, you know, just once they get in the water, I'm really looking forward to see how that works and taking lots of pictures and video.
Have you got to practice putting on a dry suit yet?
I have. I have pictures. They should be posted on the website soon of some of the science party putting on the survival suit. Really, it's kind of humorous, but it's all really serious. We, you know, safety is definitely first on these expeditions.
Absolutely. Now, you're also going to be interviewing the scientists on board. Have you started that process yet?
Not formally, but I have. You know, we've been talk storying, so I've been chatting with the different scientists doing different projects out here.
And is there a lot of difference between the scientists on board, or are they mostly all doing the same types of roles?
You know, they're actually doing pretty distinct activities. So as Scott mentioned, you know, he can be doing the ramp, the fish monitoring, and the benthic monitoring. And then we have some people doing coral work and cryptofauna work, which I'll let them explain that to you when they get on. And then we have the Maritime Heritage team who are going to be doing something totally different. But the one thing that the one similarity that runs between all of them is I've just noticed they're so passionate about the work that they're doing. And they all realize that it fits into a larger scheme of things, which is, you know, learning about this place and how to improve management of it and also other places that are similar.
Excellent. And I know you've just been transiting, but any wildlife spotted yet? Any cool seabirds or marine mammals?
Well, we have been watching the, I think it's red-footed boobies, sort of chasing each other around on the deck, trying to sit on the weather vane, chasing each other off. So that's been entertaining. You know, that's the kind of entertainment we get out here.
Absolutely.
But no, it's been really nice.
Oh, good. And how's the weather been treating you guys?
Can you believe after all of those three hurricane warnings or tropical storm warnings, it's actually really surprisingly nice. It's very calm. It's gorgeous.
Good. So we're
happy about that. We hope it lasts.
So no seasickness then, I'm guessing?
Not yet. Knock on wood.
Well, fantastic. I hope it remains calm for you and beautiful weather and successful dives. Thank you so much, Tony, and to Scott as well. Both of you are really busy, I know, prepping for your first dives tomorrow, but it's such an opportunity to chat with both of you. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Kevin Lino about underwater adventures. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Leak Master Roofing, Kamayama Solar, Grand Solar, and BenQ Solar.
Living in the street. 760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network. Going west, it's slow on the Moanalua as you approach Middle Street. Further ahead, we had an accident in the Fort Shafter overpass area. It's out of the way. The H1 slows right after you get on the airport viaduct. Kamehameha Highway traffic westbound, a little busy by Pearl Harbor, but otherwise typical out to Pearl City. Traffic going east to Hawaii Kai is normal, and it's a normal ride over to the windward side on the Pali, the Likelike, and the H3 freeway.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Kanilea, family-owned, locally manufactured in Kaneohe. Kanilea Ukulele is our local one-stop shop for all grades and styles of ukulele and guitar lele.
Aloha, it's Jeff. I'm so happy and proud to be using Kanilea's instruments. Now, the guitar lele, the koa instrument that they have made for me, is something I cherish and I'll keep for the rest of my life. I mean, honestly, it beats my Martin, it beats my Taylor, it beats my Ovation. I love the Kanilea sound. So please give them a call and check out their showroom in Kaneohe. Aloha.
Located in Kaneohe Industrial Park at 216 Kahuhipa Street. Just call 234-2868.
Acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha no hoi kako and ho mai kai no hoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha.
My name is Braden Avas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, chatting live with scientists aboard the NOAA ship Hi'ialakai in the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. Joining us now is Kevin Lino. Kevin is a NOAA Marine Ecosystems Research Coordinator for the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Good evening, Carly. It's good to be here.
It's so good to have you. Kevin, most of your work has been done with the Coral Reef Ecosystem Division. What kind of collaborations are you working on with the Monument Office and being out on the ramp crews now?
Well, as Scott mentioned, both my division, the Coral Reef Ecosystems Division, or CRED, and the Monument work together in order to meet the mandate set by the Coral Reef Conservation Act. So both of our work goes in tandem, so that we can monitor and assess all of the coral reefs throughout the U.S.-affiliated Pacific. So while my division spends a good portion of our time looking at trips in Guam, Saipan, and down to American Samoa and the Pacific remote island areas, we also survey in the Hawaiian Islands as well. So we work directly with the Monument in order to make sure that's happening.
And I know, personally, you have been out at sea quite a bit this year. I know you do a lot of trips. How does it stay exciting for you? Does it always feel like a new experience, or what is it like?
I do head out to sea quite often. That's one of my major roles within the division. Luckily, I'm a diver, and I spend a good portion of my time under the water doing my surveys. So I actually get paid to do something that I absolutely love and get to go to areas that are really hard to get to for other people so that I can assess and get some data so that we can continue to work towards the management of these areas. So I'm always looking forward to get back into the water. It's been several years since I've had a chance to get back up into the monument. So unfortunately, we're not going to my favorite atoll, which is Pearl and Hermes, but there are still some very beautiful diving areas that I'm going to be able to get in the water with.
Why Pearl and Hermes? Why is that your favorite?
It just has a lot of memories for me. I first started coming to the monument in 2005 as a marine debris technician. And that was one of the areas that we first surveyed, and I spent a good portion of time there. I've also done a lot of fish surveys and tow board surveys in that area, and it has a really unique, large area of reef to survey, both in the back reef, the fore reef, and in the lagoon. It has a really complex interior lagoon that we refer to as the maze, because the reef there is so complex and complicated, it's very easy to get lost if you're on a small boat and you're unfamiliar with the area. And we just see a lot of really beautiful wildlife throughout that entire atoll, as well as many of the other locations that we travel to.
Well, your wealth of experience definitely shines through. I know you're an accomplished dive master and boat instructor. What types of tasks do you typically do when you're out at sea? I know you mentioned you do some types of diving. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Certainly. One of my big roles on this voyage is helping get several people that do some boating a little bit more experience. And since I have come out quite often, I'm very familiar with our boating operations. I'm going to be working hand-in-hand with them, getting them up to speed and training them so that eventually they'll be able to just take over the vessels and the small vessels that we deploy off the large ship themselves. The rest of the time when I'm not aiding as a coxswain, I will be in the water counting fish and sizing fish using a random stratified design. And we do multiple dives a day, so up to 8 dives per person, but typically somewhere around 4 depending on condition depth. And we'll be going between about 6 feet down to 100 feet and looking at the fish in those areas.
So you mentioned random stratified design. That is a very fancy term. Can you explain that into a little bit more details, why you do that design and what that exactly entails?
Absolutely. The random stratified design is where we actually use benthic habitat maps ahead of time. And using overlays, we randomly select positions based off of a gridding system. So that way we're not targeting select areas and we're trying to dive as many sites as we can, but we're not specifically trying to find certain areas. So half the time that we are going out, we're not even sure exactly what we're going to find when we roll into the water. Since we can't dive everywhere over these large areas, these large atolls, you just have to get a snapshot using only a couple sites. So we try to randomize them as much as possible.
And the counting and sizing fish, I know that sounds like a ton of fun, but there's a lot more to it. I know you guys practice a lot, and there is quite a strong method into doing this. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Yes, it does sound very easy that we are basically just counting and sizing fish, but in order to do so, we really make sure that all of our divers are very thoroughly trained. The monument brings out students every year who have gone through Quest, which is a training program through the University of Hawaii on the Big Island. They go through a lot of dive training to get certified in order to dive with NOAA. There's a lot of in-classroom training where we teach the method. We have to learn all of the fish for all of these different regions that we go to. And so we need to be able to identify them instantly when we're underwater. If we really see something unique or something that we're not quite sure what it was or if it's moving too fast, and we're able to take photos and ID it later. But we need to be able to get as accurate of descriptions of these fish as possible in that area. And we're also getting size estimation where we practice before we ever get out into the field, where we use cutouts and we actually have the divers go in the water with these already pre-known sized cutouts, and they estimate how large they are to see how accurate we can get. And it's actually shown that practice does make perfect, and our divers are improving the more often that they're doing this practice. So from the numbers that we get and the sizes we get of the fish, we're actually able to calculate some biomass for all the different species. And then that'll actually give us the abundance and general idea of what's going on with the population in different areas.
That sounds like a big role. How many fish do you need to know? Like 50, or are we talking in the hundreds?
Well, we just took a fish ID test where we needed to know 100 species just for that test. We typically, on this cruise, learn about 200, 220 species. And some of them can look very similar to each other. We don't learn every single species. I know there's a bit more than that, but we can't ID things down to, you know, a couple centimeters in length because they're just really cryptic and hard to ID. So we'll try to get pictures of those, and we'll at least try to get them to family level when we do end up with those smaller, hard to identify species.
And so how do you record all of this? I mean, you can't possibly remember all those fish when you're diving and then come up and write it down.
We are underwater with data slates, and so we have worked very hard to get a data slate where the data sheet itself is fine-tuned so that we have some things already pre-written down for certain categories that we want in priority being listed, so that way we're able to just go through. And we can't get every single fish, as you're saying, so what we're doing is taking a snapshot of that environment at the time. And by snapshot, I mean we're looking at that exact site for about a five-minute time period. So any fish that's swimming through our imaginary little cylinder while we're underwater, and it's about a 7.5-meter radius cylinder that we're referencing off of a transect line we've laid down, we are recording any species that comes through in those first 5 minutes. After those 5 minutes are done, we may record a couple new species as they come in, but primarily we're going to focus on all those species that had come through, and now we go through and try to count them as best we can. A lot of it, we may have a large school of fish or something that has come through and left, so we're trying to write that down, and we're also trying to estimate as best as possible.
So are there any fish in particular that really excite you that you're hoping to see on this particular trip?
Absolutely. There are a couple species that are endemic to Hawaii that are fairly hard to find in the main Hawaiian Islands, but a bit more common in the northwest Hawaiian Islands. One is a type of Bulginocampus personata. It's a really beautiful angelfish that's only commonly seen at a reasonable diving depth in the northwest Hawaiian Islands. And then one of my favorite fish is an endemic Kinesis fetatus, which is the Hawaiian morwong, which is pretty unique, and they're a little bit deeper if you are able to find them in the main Hawaiian Islands. So in the northwest, you're actually able to see them at a shallower depth. And they're a really interesting fish. There's only a couple species that are found in the northern hemisphere within that family. I think there's about 8 to 10 within that family, and all of them are mostly in the southern hemisphere. So it's a really unique fish that I like to see. And of course, I'm always looking forward to seeing large sharks and jacks and just the diversity that you're able to see in these islands.
Well, hopefully I will get a chance to see some of your pictures, and fingers crossed, maybe you'll happen upon a morwong. Thank you so much, Kevin, for taking some time to talk today. I also wanted to catch Courtney Couch, a postdoctoral researcher who's on the research cruise right now. Courtney is a postdoc studying coral disease at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology with the University of Hawaii and the Nature Conservancy. Courtney, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Not as good as you, though, out in this beautiful place. Now, you study coral disease and epidemiology. What specifically are you looking at on this cruise?
So on this cruise, what I'm hoping to do is build off of some of the earlier work that the Coral Reef Ecosystem Division is conducted, as well as Dr. Greta Abiat, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. So essentially what I'm doing is I'm working with Scott and another graduate student, John Burns, at University of Hawaii at Hilo to expand the monitoring and get a good sense of how the diseases are spatially distributed across the reef, who's affected, so what species are affected. And then if time permits, we're hoping to revisit some of the earlier sites that Dr. Abby recorded or looked at earlier. It was around 2005, 2006.
Are there particular...
To figure out whether diseases are changing over time.
Are there particular species of coral that are more susceptible to diseases that you're concerned with?
Yeah, so the faster growing species, and this isn't just for the Hawaiian Islands, but across the Indo-Pacific, the faster growing species, like the big branching acropods, are generally more susceptible to diseases that cause mortality or faster spreading tissue loss. But there are other diseases. There are other corals like the parietes of the lobe coral, the finger coral, that are more susceptible to some of the slower progressing diseases. They have what are called tumors or growth anomalies. So it just depends on what diseases you're talking about. But yeah, there are certain.
Well, hopefully no diseases. I'm hoping you guys don't see too
yeah,
much.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, when you're out there. When you're out there looking at these corals and looking for these diseases or what's happening on the reef, how do you make those connections to larger environmental change? Are you able to do that from the work that you're doing?
That's the hope, for sure. So what we're hoping to do is integrate the data that we're collecting in the monument with a larger scale analysis across the Indo-Pacific to look at how local factors such as climate change are affecting diseases, and then can we use these areas such as the monument that are really remote as sort of baselines for other regions to figure out what's the relative importance of the global and local stressors.
And it's so important to look across larger scales. I know that you're involved with looking at coral disease across several of the big ocean sites. Can you tell us a little bit about the big ocean sites and how you're connecting all of that together?
Of course. It's been one of my... I've worked on many, many wonderful projects this year, and that's been one of my favorites. So Big Ocean is a collaborative network of seven of the world's largest marine protected areas. And the hope is that with this network, they'll be able to learn from each other and improve the efficacy of their management. And so what I'm hoping to do is, because coral disease is part of pretty much, or disease in general is part of any wildlife population, but it is on many of our world's reefs, I'm trying to standardize the disease monitoring across these very large marine protected areas. And again, like I mentioned before, these areas, because they're some of the most remote regions and near pristine intact ecosystems, it'll be important to figure out or learn from those areas in terms of how diseases are changing over time and what's the importance or how can we use those lessons to implement them in the local areas.
So this is a great science project that really seems to be applicable to marine resource managers. How do you make this science available to managers and other communities that you're working in?
So one of the things that I'm hoping to do and that I am doing is that I'm actively involving coral reef managers right from the get-go. So we're involving them in discussions, training their personnel to be able to go out and when they are doing their monitoring, they can actually be able to identify disease and notify disease experts. But then also make sure that the disease experts and the managers are talking and asking the right questions and addressing the management needs. And then through that whole process, we can have regular communication about the results and make sure that the interpretation of those results are, that everyone's clear on that. So in addition to that, we're doing the trainings, and then we have a lot of this is also being made available through reporting and other avenues.
It's so important to do that. And I'm really curious in looking at these past sites that were monitored, and how do you compare them, a specific site from future to past? You know, do you know you're at the same spot? Do you use GPS? Do you use photographs? Mm-hmm. How do you compare those historical data with what you're looking at now?
Yeah, it's certainly challenging for sure, because it's a really big ocean. but we have, we use a combination of different methods. So I have photographs of the specific sites. I have GPS points, so we take handheld GPSs with us onto the boats. And then sometimes there are even permit stakes that were placed in the dead part of the substrate. And so we can use the combination of the different methods to identify the exact region. And then we know, you know, along what compass bearing we lay our transect line, and we can go back to the exact same area and look at the change over time.
Well, I'm really excited to see what results you get from this research cruise, Courtney. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks. And Kevin as well, same to you.
Of course.
Thank you. And we are going to take a quick traffic break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Kelly Gleason. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, University of Hawaii Research Corporation, State of Hawaii Natural Energy Lab Kona, D.R. Horton Schuller Homes, and University of Hawaii Federal Credit Union.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Accidents right now in Ia on the H1 eastbound at the Ia exit, on the Pali Highway downtown by the new Uana YMCA, and on the airport viaduct, there's an accident on the H1 westbound at the Hickam exit. If you're going west, the H1 slows at the airport exit on the viaduct. The Moanalua backed up in Kalihi before Middle Street. Windward traffic is normal and no problems going out east to Hawaii Kai.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200. Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200, and aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
My name is Britton DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, chatting live with scientists aboard the NOAA ship Hi'ialakai and the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. With us now is Dr. Kelly Gleason, Maritime Heritage Coordinator with the monument. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kelly, you have been exploring maritime heritage resources in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands for quite some time, I think since 2004. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and some of the exciting resources that you've been looking at?
Well, in addition to the incredible natural resources in Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, there's also a wealth of historic and cultural resources. And so my job is to take a look at the human history of the monument. And while seafaring history goes back thousands of years in the Pacific, through the material culture, the shipwrecks, and the sunken aircraft sites, I'm kind of putting the pieces of these stories together to better understand the human interaction with this place over the past couple hundred years.
And you've uncovered some fantastic stories and shipwrecks over the years. Do you have a particular favorite?
There are so many that are pretty fascinating, but I think one of the ones that stands out to me because of the incredible story that unfolded was one that was discovered in 2012, and it's actually a sunken aircraft site associated with World War II. And there are, despite the fact that the Battle of Midway is a huge part of the story of Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, we haven't discovered many of the sunken aircraft sites associated with that battle. But in 2012, someone on Coralreef Ecosystem Division's marine debris team came across some wreckage of an airplane, reported it to my team, who was able to go up and investigate the site, put the story together that it was a pretty rare World War II fighter aircraft, a Brewster Buffalo. And then what was really incredible and kind of, to me, what makes maritime archaeology so exciting was the fact that we were able to put the pieces of the puzzle together and then connect with the family of the pilot and make it a much broader story and really help people understand why archaeological sites like that one, like the shipwreck sites, are about much more than just, you know, the artifacts on the seafloor, but they're what connects people to this place, too.
Fascinating. And that's just one example. I know you've done a lot of other work. I believe a couple of years back you found a shipwreck, the Two Brothers. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was another one of the most interesting projects that I've worked on. And that was a discovery made in 2008 by a team of maritime archaeologists that I was leading up here. And we came across at that time what we just knew to be a whaling shipwreck site. It took us about 2 years to actually determine the identity of this site. And what made it so exciting for a number of reasons is the fact that it was a whaling ship out of Nantucket, but also connected with one of the most notorious seafaring disasters ever, and that's the whale ship Essex, which was stove by a whale in the South Pacific and inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick, which is such an important piece of literature. But then part of you know, the Essex story didn't really end there. The captain of the Essex went back to Nantucket and then headed back out to sea a second time on the whale ship Two Brothers, which ended up in disaster again. And so it's the story of a really unlucky man, the seafaring captain. But then it's also just this incredible story that connects Hawaii to Nantucket and New England and reminds us of what a big part of seafaring history that whaling heritage was in the early 1800s.
You have such an exciting job. I mean, what a unique thing to be able to unfold the history and bring it into present day. I imagine it's quite a long process. Can you walk us through from start to finish kind of what happens once you find something underwater or you get reported that someone has found something underwater? How do you go from a piece underwater to a full story?
Well, it can happen in a number of different ways. And sometimes there are other scientists or managers working up here who report a site or an artifact or something that they think is man-made to myself or someone in our office, and I'll have the opportunity to follow up and investigate it. And that's the case with the sunken aircraft I described at Midway, where there was a member of the Marine Debris Team, and they cover a ton of ground and are great for reporting artifact sites to us. But then also, we do a lot of archival research prior to any expedition we go on. I spend lots of time in libraries looking at newspapers to find out what's going to be out there, what's potentially going to be in the areas we look. So we'll start with areas of potential loss. And so a lot of times they're very vague, and so we have to do a lot of searching, just long dives or tow boarding, which is another way we find a lot of sites, so just kind of towing behind a boat, searching large areas. And then once we find a site, our job is to map those sites. We take a lot of photo documentation, we measure, we create measured sketches, and kind of that's where it becomes a little bit like detective work, and we kind of look at it, I guess, a little bit like someone would look at a crime scene and try to put it all together and connect what we're looking at with not only what's the type of ship or type of aircraft, but then also what's the story, who was on that ship, who was on that aircraft, and make it something that's relevant to people and makes it something that makes the place come alive and makes people realize they have a really a real connection to the place.
So typically, do the artifacts that you find, they remain in the place that you find them in, or do you take them for processing to get more information or put them in a museum?
It's very rare that we recover any artifacts, and that's for a couple different reasons. It's an expensive process. If something's been on the seafloor for a couple hundred years, it takes a long time and a lot of resources to restore it to the state where it's stable and can be displayed in a museum or used for research. And so in very rare cases, if it's an artifact that's really important for research or education and outreach, we may recover something. And that was the case with the Two Brothers shipwreck site, where we found a number of very unique artifacts. And then in addition to the fact that they were unique and helpful for identification of the site, this was a project that one of the challenges for me is the fact that we're in such a remote place. And so trying to make a site that we discover relevant to a broader public, it takes a lot of effort to try to bring that place, to the people. And so we can do that through museum exhibits. And so we've done that in a couple cases. And with the Two Brothers, we wanted to be able to share that story with a broader public. And so we incorporated some of the artifacts into a museum exhibit that's currently in Nantucket, Massachusetts, and will make its way back to Hawaii. But it is, in a few cases, we have done that, but it's very rare because it does take a lot of resources. And, it's something that we need to make sure we have all the infrastructure to do that.
Sure, absolutely. And you don't work on shipwreck sites just in the monument, as I understand. You go all over the world for these types of dives and stories, correct?
Yeah.
And are there any... Do you have any favorites outside of Hawaii?
I've had the opportunity... I've had the opportunity to collaborate with a number of my colleagues who work around the sanctuary program, but I'd say probably one of... the most interesting shipwreck sites that I've worked on was down in the Caribbean in another warm environment where there was a British warship called the HMS Santa Monica that ran aground on the island of St. John, and it had actually been a Spanish warship that was captured by the British. So there was a real interesting story to its past, and then it just kind of opened up the story of the British warships patrolling around the Caribbean at that time. So it was a story. It was where archaeology kind of made history come alive in that case. So that's one that just speaks to me as, you know, a way that archaeology was able to kind of shed light on a particular part of history.
And you're a very busy woman, not just working on shipwrecks in the monument and outside of Hawaii. You also have a rare certification, a level 3 closed circuit rebreather diver. It's a lot of words. What exactly is this? Tell me a little bit about it.
Okay, well, I'm lucky to be part of a team at Papahanaumokuakea, the field and research team. There are a number of us who are deep divers, and we have been certified as mixed gas divers, open circuit for a while, and then a few years ago became closed circuit rebreather divers. So that basically means that underwater we're breathing, we kind of have these units on our back that recycle the air. It allows you to dive underwater for a long period of time, but it also keeps you kind of allows a level of safety to maintain certain depths for a longer period of time. And I always got into deeper diving because I was interested in the doors that would open up for me investigating maritime heritage sites at deeper depths. And I was always curious what might be down below that's undiscovered. And so that's kind of what encouraged me to dive deep. But the monuments team that I typically dive with now on rebreathers is actually investigating the mesopodic reef system. So, of course, every time I dive down, I'm hoping to discover some new shipwreck or sunken aircraft site. But in the meantime, I'm part of a team that's just exploring these reefs for a number of different resources.
And have you been able to find any shipwrecks or any type of new discoveries at these deeper depths when you're diving?
To date, not yet, but definitely I'm hopeful. And I've, as we're still discovering new shipwreck and sunken aircraft sites in 10 to 20 feet of water in the monument, I'm pretty hopeful that there's plenty to discover at deeper depths as well.
So are there any particular plans for this cruise this time around? Are you visiting sites that you already know of? Are you looking for new sites?
The exciting thing about this particular cruise for me is that I have the opportunity to explore a number of different potential sites. So it's an opportunity for a lot of discovery and exploration, and on many cruises I'm going back to sites that are known, but in this case, there are so many. We're getting a chance to visit some new spots at Lisianski and at Midway as well, where we've really never had the opportunity to search in these areas where shipwreck survivors report these shipwrecks lost. So we're pretty excited for what we may find. There's a lot of potential for interesting discovery on this cruise.
And I bet there are so many people listening thinking, such an exciting job looking at all the history and being able to incorporate the diving in that. How did you get into this profession? What advice would you give for someone who wanted to go into maritime archaeology?
Well, it was a career that I came across when I was younger, and I was always someone who was interested in a career that would get me in or around the ocean. But I was also more of a humanities history. I loved history, and I loved social studies. And so when I heard that there was this thing called maritime archaeology that combined history and getting underwater, I was pretty excited. So I pursued underwater archaeology. Really, it's difficult to study as an undergrad, and so I began studying specifically maritime archaeology as a graduate student. And my advice to anyone would be just any opportunity they have to jump on a project, do it, because that's kind of how I got to where I am, is that I just, any way I could get experience, I tagged along or I paid my own way, and it does pay off, and you get a lot of good opportunities that way.
That's fantastic, Kelly. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and fingers crossed that you stumble across something really exciting on this trip. And I know if people want to learn more about the Ramp Cruise or about the Papahana Mokuakea, they can visit the website, papahanamokuakea.gov. I'd like to thank all of my guests today for taking some time. I know it's probably about dinner on the ship, so please go enjoy, and I can't wait to hear more about your diving experiences. I'd like to also acknowledge Jeff Davis, the solar guy, for all your solar needs, 554-7200, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.